still to come on the programme, Michael Noonan met the IMF's Christine Lagarde last night. We'll be speaking to Alan Ahern about what could have been on the agenda. You may have received notice to pay your property tax already. Revenue will be in to tell us more. A referendum on same-sex marriage is on the cards. The chair of the Constitutional Convention, Tom Arnold, which recommended the move, joins us. And the building which provided much inspiration for John McGahern's writings is to be converted into a reading room and museum. We'll be talking to those in Cute Hall involved in the project.
The time is 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 29th of October. This is Morning Ireland with Fran McNulty and Rachel English.
The headlines. Officials from the Troika will make their 12th and final visit to Dublin today, ahead of Ireland's exit from the EU IMF bailout programme in December. Airlines are expected to operate as normal today after being disrupted by a severe storm which claimed the lives of at least 13 people across Northern Europe. And the Teachers Union of Ireland has said it doesn't believe it will be possible to phase in the new junior certificate programme next autumn. Clodagh Walsh has the news in full.
Officials from the Troika will make their 12th and final visit to Dublin today, ahead of Ireland's exit from the EU IMF bailout programme in December. Ireland will become the first Eurozone country to exit the EU IMF bailout programme. Aisling Kenny reports.
Discussions between the government and the Troika are likely to focus on the need to establish a post-bailout emergency credit line for Ireland. Although the European Commission has recently signalled that market conditions are very favourable for Ireland and that it has strong cash buffers, the government is still thought to be interested in having a credit line. The emergency fund would be used to build confidence in Ireland among the international money markets in case of any unforeseen crisis when Ireland exits the bailout. Last night, the Minister for Finance, Michael Noonan, had dinner with the IMF chief Christine Lagarde in Washington, having already discussed Ireland's position with the EU Economics Commissioner Ollie Wren and with ECB officials in Frankfurt. Ireland will become the first Eurozone country to exit the EU IMF bailout programme, having acquired the financial assistance in November 2010.
At least 13 people have died across Northern Europe in a severe storm that earlier claimed the lives of four people in Britain, including an Irish man. Airlines here are expected to operate normal schedules today, Sinead Morris reports.
Yesterday saw winds of up to almost 160 kilometres an hour hit parts of southern Britain. Several people died, including 51-year-old Donal Drowan, originally from Waterford, who was killed when a tree fell on his car in Watford. A number of other people were killed in storm-related incidents in Germany, the Netherlands, France and Denmark. Here, Aer Lingus said there had been a significant amount of disruption to flights yesterday, but passengers had been accommodated on later flights. Both Ryanair and Aer Lingus are operating normal schedules today. Two P&O sailings have been cancelled this morning due to a technical fault. Passengers will be accommodated on later crossings. And AA Roadwatch is warning drivers to slow down due to wet road conditions across the country this morning. Sinead Morris, RTE News.
The Teachers Union of Ireland has raised concerns about elements of the new Junior Cert programme, which is scheduled to begin on a phased basis next year for first examination in 2017. Speaking on this programme, Education Officer Bernie Judge said the TUI was not happy with the assessment model being proposed and that the new syllabus will shift assessment from an externally monitored system to the school and teachers. She said the TUI didn't believe it would be possible to phase in the new system next autumn.
We're not confident that there's been enough discussion at all around the very sharp shift from, and I appreciate that it's on a phased basis, but we don't believe you should begin something unless you're absolutely clear that it will work well. So we're not confident that next autumn is the right time to do it. But I will say that our members are very deeply concerned about the move to school-based assessment and deeply concerned that the overall quality of outcome for students over time will be negative rather than positive.
The US President Barack Obama has ordered a review of US spying operations as European leaders push for new limits on its surveillance programs. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, one of the reported targets of the program, has protested the surveillance, as have other nations such as Spain and France. A series of news reports based on disclosures by former US analyst Edward Snowden described vast NSA powers to monitor phone calls and internet communications throughout the world. President Obama has said he wants to review security operations to ensure privacy is protected.
The national security operations generally have one purpose, and that is to make sure that the American people are safe and that I'm making good decisions, and I'm the final user of all the intelligence that they gather. But they're involved in a whole wide range of issues, and we give them policy direction, but what we've seen over the last several years is their capacities continue to develop and expand, and that's why I'm initiating now a review to make sure that what they're able to do doesn't necessarily mean what they should be doing.
In Britain, a former BBC chauffeur charged with sex offences as part of the investigation triggered by allegations of abuse against Jimmy Savile has been found dead at his home. David Smith, who was 66, was the first person to be charged under Operation Yew Tree. Smith failed to turn up at Southwark Crown Court in London for the start of his trial yesterday morning. Officers later found his body at his home in southeast London. The cause of death is not yet known. And now the time is 5:30 past eight.
Here with what it says in Tuesday's papers is Deirdre Purcell.
There are two stories common to all the papers this morning. The huge storm that ravaged the UK and Europe yesterday and the triumph of the two Irish athletes, Maria McCambridge and Sean Hare, in yesterday's Dublin City Marathon. Meanwhile, Patsy McGarry's piece on the front page of the Irish Times this morning is based on a review of the Murphy Commission's findings about child abuse and the Roman Catholic clergy here. According to the article, this review, commissioned by the Association of Irish Priests and written by barrister Fergal Sweeney, says that the practices and procedures of the Murphy Commission fell far short of meeting the requirements of natural and constitutional justice. The Times lead story from Suzanne Lynch in Washington tells us that Ireland might, after all, choose to exit its bailout programme without the support of a backstop emergency credit line. This is according to the Minister for Finance, who, as you heard in the bulletin, met with IMF officials yesterday in Washington. For the Irish Independent, Caroline Crawford's lead tells us that, according to a new Irish study, nearly half of GPs here have been prescribing antibiotics when these might not have been needed. We're also told on the Independent's front page that dozens of schools are employing teachers under the JobBridge scheme. For the Irish Examiner's main story, Stephen Rogers tells us that more than 1,000 drivers have avoided a conviction and penalty points so far this year by making a donation to a court poor box. The Irish Daily Mail's lead by its crime correspondent Ali Bracken is that following a tip-off from Australia, cold case detectives here may have made a major breakthrough that could help solve the stabbing to death of Irene White, who was washing dishes in her home, known as the Ice House, in Dundalk when she was killed. Detectives plan now to interview the person who has come forward. The Herald lead refers back to yesterday's story about the death of a 19-year-old who had been attempting to cross the old N1 Dublin to Belfast road near Monaster Boyce when he was fatally struck by a car. The story by Alan O'Keefe and Elaine Keogh tells us that the young man was crossing to visit his grandmother's house when the accident happened at the same spot where his grandfather was killed in 1991. In a story labelled exclusive, the Irish Daily Star tells us that from tomorrow there should be a drop of 2 cents in the retail price of petrol at the pumps. There's a new film in the pipeline about the rise to fame of Susan Boyle, that's in The Sun. And picture of the day is on the back page of The Examiner. Taken by Niall Carson for the PA Wire Service, it has been picked up in many other papers but is given full glory on the back page of The Examiner. What we see in pin-sharp detail is a black crow perched on the head of a fawn in Dublin's Phoenix Park. And in one of the Examiner's editorial pieces, the writer asks if we're about to have another property bubble, as prices, particularly in Dublin, rise to a level unimaginable even a few months ago, with speculators once again buying up land and sitting on it in the hope of high returns. The paper reminds us that those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Meanwhile, the lead editorial in The Independent is headlined, "Troika Medicine Was Painful But Necessary." That in The Times is concerned with President Higgins' visit to Latin America and tells us that trips like these are important in realising the benefits of making more political, cultural and economic contacts. And finally, in The Examiner, Fergus Finlay is writing movingly about the death of his Izzy, part collie, part red setter with the legs of an Alsatian. Izzy's collie was as bright as a button, but her red setter was as thick as a plank. Collie knew she wasn't allowed near kitchen cupboards or the kitchen bin, but red setter couldn't resist them and always seemed to believe we humans wouldn't notice the trail of destruction, even the fully decorated Christmas tree dragged into the back garden.
13 minutes after 8 o'clock is the time now with Morning Ireland. The Troika will begin its 12th and final mission to Dublin this morning. Michael Noonan met the IMF's Christine Lagarde last night. Concentration now turning to what happens after Ireland exits the bailout. There's much talk of a precautionary credit line which may be needed as a safety net of sorts. Alan Ahern is Head of Economics at the Cairns School of Business and Economics at NUI Galway and is in our Galway studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Fran.
Is there a reality, Alan Ahern, that this precautionary credit line is needed and will be a reality despite what Michael Noonan may have had to say about the issue last night?
It certainly looks like the Troika would like something like that. And I guess, whether we need something like that depends on how you think the next 12 months are going to pan out. There are certainly a lot of risks. Remember, the main reason we ended up needing financial assistance from the Troika was because of what happened in the banking system. And the Europe has started a new round of so-called stress tests for the banking system. And they're going to go on really right through 2014, right through next year, up until next November. So it's wrong to say, I think, that the euro area crisis is over, and therefore it's wrong to think that although things are fine now in financial markets and there's little stress, that things might not flare up again. There is certainly a huge, a significant risk that things may flare up again. And if they do, it's nice to have some sort of insurance behind us that we have funding, and this contingency credit line or backstop or overdraft is really an insurance policy. And I think, therefore, it would be valuable.
Arthur Beasley of the Irish Times spoke to us earlier in the programme and he spoke about the difficulty of the government putting in place a measure like this, because we had been told we were moving on. This was the end of the bailout and this looks like a second measure, so to speak. It looks like we're not putting clear blue water between us and the IMF and the ECB and people who are helping us. What about the markets and the reality of perception with them as opposed to that political perception?
Well, we don't want to become victims of our own political rhetoric. There's a lot of talk about losses of economic sovereignty and regaining economic sovereignty when the bailout ends, but a lot of that is just nonsense. There are going to be conditions no matter what. We are part of the European Union. We are part of the euro area. We have got all the new rules on budgetary policy. We have got heightened surveillance of countries, not just their fiscal policies, but also other economic policies right across the euro area. So that's the world we're emerging into, the new European Union. And therefore, we talk about, well, we don't want to have conditions, external conditions imposed on us. There are going to be external conditions no matter what. So it's not a case of let's gamble, let's take a risk so that we can say that we have economic sovereignty or economic independence. We're a small open economy in a globalized world. We have chosen to share our economic independence a long time ago, and so there really is no such thing.
It's probably a bit early to start the Troika post-mortem, but they're done now. This is their final mission. They aren't really going to instill any major significant change from here on out. Are there things they have missed out on? Are there things that the Troika should have and could have done but failed to do?
Well, first of all, I think it's unambiguously a good thing that we're getting back into markets. The Troika program was always supposed to be temporary. The Troika will not continue to lend to you indefinitely. And since financial markets have calmed down, we've got our budget deficit down, we are now have access again to the bond markets. And that means we can get private money into the country, private money to the state to finance its borrowing and into the banking system. And that's a good thing. I guess the focus really of the Troika program was on getting the budget deficit down, which had to be done in any event, and on fixing the banking system, which had to be done. I think there are still worries about the banking system, that we're not getting the sort of credit that we should be from the banking system. And there's another, as I said, another round of stress tests to come. So there's still question marks, I think, about the banking system, which is part of the reason that the Troika are so reluctant, I think, to completely disappear, because if they want to sign off on the programme, they want to be signing off knowing that the main problem in the Irish economy, the banks, have been fixed. And I think they're not yet convinced of that.
All right. Alan Ahern of NUI Galway, thanks for coming into us this morning.
Many households have been receiving letters over the past few days letting them know how much property tax they will have to pay next year. But be warned, if you choose to pay by direct debit or credit card, your payment will be taken before Christmas, even though the money isn't due until next year. Vivian Dempsey is the local property tax manager with the Revenue Commissioners, and she's here. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
First things first, this letter, why are we getting it now? What's the purpose of it?
Okay, the Revenue Commissioners are writing to most property owners about their 2014 payment. And the people that we're focusing on are those property owners who made a single payment. So just to correct one of the things you mentioned in your introduction, direct debit will not be taken out immediately. So maybe one of the things we'll go through will be the actual payment methods. So what we're asking property owners who made a single payment, so that would be somebody who paid by check, paid by cash in full, paid by single debit authority, or paid by debit card or credit card, how are they going to pay their property tax for 2014?
And is it the case then that most people who paid the property tax in 2013, that most people paid via just one single payment?
The vast majority of people paid by a single payment, about 46%, for example, paid by debit card or credit card.
So most people then will be getting this letter?
Most people will be getting that. About 960,000 people will be getting a letter. But the very simple message, Rachel, is that this has just selecting your payment option for 2014. The important thing is that the tax is not due until the 1st of January 2014. All you need to do at this stage is not pay the tax, but pick your payment method and then advise Revenue. And there's two important deadlines. If you're selecting your payment option and filling out a paper return, and there's about 230,000 of our property owners who like to do business with us by paper and who filed a paper return, you must select that payment option and advise us by the 7th of November. If you're going online to do that, and again, we gave you your property ID and your PIN number, which will allow you access your local property tax record via www.revenue.ie. Just log in, select your payment option, and notify Revenue by the 27th of November.
Okay, then. So really, we're talking about a system that's similar to that for people who self-assess their own tax. You get a bit more time if you're willing to do it online.
That's it, exactly.
Now, some people won't have to do anything when they get this letter. Who are those people?
Okay, those that will not receive a letter, and it's very important that we tell everybody not to expect a letter, because we got quite a number of calls last year from people who didn't get letters. So if you have paid your local property tax through deduction at source, in other words, from your wages, from your pension, or from your Department of Social Protection payment, or if you're on direct debit, these payment methods roll over year after year.
So you won't hear anything at all?
You won't be hearing it from Revenue. If you opted to defer your tax, we won't be writing to you. Or if you qualified for an exemption, we won't be writing to you. So it's only those property owners who literally have to tell us how they're going to pay their 2014 liability who need to contact Revenue and who can expect to hear from us.
Now, you mentioned the date, the 1st of January. This time of year, you know, the next 2, 3, 4 months is a terrible time of the year to be taking money from anybody, because people have so many other commitments and may well be very worried anyway. Who are the people who are going to have to pay up on or by the 1st of January? Who are the people who are going to have the money taken from them before then?
Well, this will be completely within the control of the property owner, because regardless of how you paid your local property tax in 2013, you can select an alternative payment method for 2014. So everybody can choose to pay by phased payments. And if you do, if you pay out of your wages, then your payment starts on the first paycheck from January. If you pay by direct debit, it's the 15th of every month. But as I say, there was a substantial number of people who chose to pay their local property tax in one lump sum. And if you do that, if you pay by debit card or by credit card, exactly as you pay for everything else by debit card or credit card, nothing to do with local property tax, when you make that payment, when you process that, the payment comes out immediately.
So again, the payment will come out in November?
The payment will come out as you're making that entry, exactly in November.
Is there anything you can do about this? Because as we were saying, and you were nodding your head there, this is a terribly tough time of year for a lot of people. I'm sure the last thing they want to do is to be handing over what, €1,000 maybe in some cases, prior to Christmas.
Well, again, as I say, this is within the control of the residential property owner. And if they want to pay by a single payment, they have the option of paying by a single debit authority. That's a commitment to make one single payment in a lump sum. And if you choose that option, you have until the 21st of March 2014.
All right, so there's a colossal difference there. If you pay via a credit card, you'll have to hand over the money in November. But if you pay via this authorisation, the money coming from your bank account, you have until March.
You have until the 21st of March. So again, all of these details are set out in the payment options that are on our revenue system, our online system. So look at these payment options. Decide which one suits you best. And the important thing is, having made your selection, that you notify revenue by the 7th of November if you're filing a paper return, or by the 27th of November if you're paying online. But the choice of your payment method is completely up to the property owner.
And what if you don't hear from people?
Well, again, the people that we're writing to, those property owners that we're writing to, are those who filed a return last year for 2013 and who made their payment method. But again, 90% compliance rate. For those who do not comply, and Revenue have been very clear on this, we owe it to those taxpayers who do comply to pursue the property owners who do not. And again, the normal enforcement methods, deduction at source, and the various other means that are available to the revenue will be put into operation to collect the tax from those who do not comply.
Vivian Dempsey, Local Property Tax Manager with the Revenue Commissioners, thank you for joining us on Morning Ireland.
If you thought the recent referendum was the last one for a while, think again. The Taoiseach said over the weekend that a referendum on same-sex marriage will be held during this government's lifetime, possibly next year. Yesterday on the News at One, the Education Minister, Rory Quinn, appeared to indicate there could be several issues bundled together at the same time on the same day. So are we in for more than one referendum on the same day? Tom Arnold is the chairperson of the Constitutional Convention and is here. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Frank.
Your convention recommended a change in the Constitution on the same-sex marriage issue. Remind us of the other proposals or observations that the convention had to make that could result in a referendum.
We were given the task of examining 8 specific issues in the Constitution, and then a 9th issue, any other business, where anyone could raise any issue that they felt. Now, of the 8 issues, we've dealt with 7, and we'd be dealing with the remaining issue, which is dealing with blasphemy this coming weekend. And of the 7 issues that we've dealt with already, we would have made recommendations which would require referendums in the case of 5 of those.
Would you expect that to happen? Would you expect those 5 issues to be put to a referendum?
Well, you know, ultimately that's up to the government, because our task is to examine issues, to make recommendations. After that, we lodge a report in the Houses of the Oireachtas. The Oireachtas debates that report, and government takes a decision at that point whether or not to proceed to referendum.
What are the possible options?
The possible ones that we've dealt with already are, firstly, the voting age. The recommendation was to reduce the voting age from the current 18 to 16. That was by a small majority, but it was a recommendation. The second one was the issue of the role of women in the home, the article dealing with that, and there was a very high level of support for a change in that. The third one was same-sex marriage. The fourth issue we dealt with was electoral reform, and there what was recommended was not a change in the current electoral system, but there are a whole series of other recommendations for political reform which would not require constitutional change. The fifth issue then, it was the question of whether citizens abroad should have the right to vote in presidential elections. And there was, again, a high majority in favour of that.
Do you think that those issues warrant being put to referendum?
Well, again, this is a matter for government. I mean, we were established with a mandate to examine these issues. So I assume at the time there was a judgment that if they were asked to be examined, that they ultimately should possibly go to referendum.
What's your view on the issue? Because the turnout in the last referendum was really quite poor. And there is the risk that referendum fatigue could set in, that people just get tired of having to vote. Would that be a concern you would share?
Well, there's definitely a risk there. And when we were debating the electoral reform, for example, there was a very strong concern about the lack of engagement, the relatively small turnouts in referendums. And there was a whole series of suggestions as to how that might be improved. Better citizen education, just more engagement, just making it easier for people to vote. So I think that that's a much more general question. And I think certainly it is important that citizenry engage with the political process.
Would you say that those measures should be looked at before we possibly have a day of referenda next year sometime?
I think so. I think that's a basic issue for our democracy. And I think certainly it's a strand running through our work that we need better engagement with the public on matters political.
Just in conclusion, Tom Arnold, what's next for the convention? You have meetings this weekend, you're saying, discussing blasphemy. What happens next?
Well, we have meetings. Actually, we're dealing with the last issue of blasphemy this weekend, but then we have this any other business. And we're actually holding a series of meetings with the public around the country where people can come and express their views as to what should be on that agenda. The next meeting is tomorrow evening in Galway, and I invite anyone who wants to turn up.
All right. Tom Arnold, chairperson of the Constitutional Convention. Thanks for coming into us this morning.
At least 13 people have been killed in a storm which battered northwestern Europe over the weekend. A 51-year-old man who was originally from Waterford was among those killed in Britain. Donald Drohan, a father of three, lived in Harrow in northwest London, and he died after a tree fell on his car in Watford. Joining us on the line is Councillor Susan Hall, who's the leader of Harrow Council. Good morning.
Good morning.
I gathered Donald worked for the council for many years.
Yes, he was one of our wonderful, wonderful officers for 25 years.
By all accounts, he was a very popular man. Will you tell us a little about him?
Oh, gosh. He was everything you would want somebody, a human being, to be. He was kind, he was honest, he was caring. It sounds, you know, all the good words, but that just describes Donal. He would always do anything for anybody in trouble. He was always joking around. I mean, he was an absolute delight to be with and work with and just know, quite frankly.
And I see some of his colleagues quoted this morning as saying that he was very passionate about his job as well.
Oh, God, yes, he was. And he put in extra work, and if ever you wanted anything done, he never minded if it was past his hours or earlier than you'd think. He'd just put his hand to it and he'd do whatever anybody asked and thought for himself. He often used to go off and do things just to make things better for the residents of Harrow. I mean, he'll be sorely missed by certainly everybody that ever came into contact with him.
What sort of impact has this tragedy had on the council?
It's just devastating because, I mean, yesterday we had a massive amount to do, as you can imagine, with the storm, with well over 100 trees down just in our borough. And normally, Donal would have been there in the forefront of it all, just, you know, making himself busy and checking that the crews were where they should be and just generally rolling his sleeves up and helping. So clearly we had 120 officers out working yesterday and some of them just had to go home. They're absolutely devastated at his loss.
Well, listen, many thanks indeed for taking our call this morning. That was Susan Hall, who's the leader of Harrow Council in London, and our sympathies to the friends and family of the late Donal Drohan.
Darren's back with sport.
Good morning to you, Fran. The Irish coach Joe Schmidt will find out today whether out-half Johnny Sexton will have to return to Racing Metro tomorrow for top 14 duty at the weekend. The Ireland squad are in camp ahead of the November internationals against Samoa, Australia and New Zealand. The campaign opens up with a game against Samoa on Saturday week. Now, it's unlikely Sexton would play in that opening game, but it had been hoped he could get some rest after a hectic couple of months with the Lions and his new club in France. Michael Corcoran has been speaking to the Irish manager Mick Harney about this situation.
Yeah, Jonathan played against Stade Francais late on Saturday night in Paris, and he arrived into Dublin Sunday morning. Good chat with him last night, so he's in very good form. He did a bit of a skill session this morning. He'll train fully this afternoon. Johnny's played, I think, 13 games in 12 weeks, and that was after obviously a very arduous Lions tour. He then got married, and he was honeymoon, and then pretty well straight back into training, pre-season training with Racing. So it's not an ideal situation. There's a possibility that he may be called back to France on Wednesday. to play for Racing against Biarritz on Saturday. So again, that's not an ideal scenario with us training on both Thursday and Friday.
Obviously, I would imagine you would prefer if that phone call from France didn't come.
Absolutely. I know that Joe is working hard at it to try and make sure that he doesn't actually have to return. But unfortunately, it's a situation that's actually out of our hands, in that if Racing insists that he goes back to play for them against Biarritz down in Biarritz, well then Johnny has to do that.
Now, something which is outside of your remit, perhaps outside your control as well, Conor Murray cited for an incident during the game against Glasgow the other night. How disruptive is that in terms of obviously having to attend a hearing?
Well, I think it's very disappointing for Conor, obviously, number one. I thought there was very little in it, but there's going to be a hearing now on Wednesday, I believe, and it's up to the powers that be to decide if there's anything more in it than that.
Yeah, fingers crossed for Conor Murray this week. A busy week for the Irish management team. The squad will continue their preparations for the internationals at Carton House today. Joe Schmidt with a very long casualty list. Paul O'Connell, Sean O'Brien, Keane Healy, Keith Earls, Declan Fitzpatrick and Robbie Henshaw all carrying various knocks. Andrew Trimble, Donegal Callaghan, Martin Moore and Roger Wilson have been added to the squad as cover. London Irish are expected to announce the signing of the controversial Australian player James O'Connor today. A press conference has been called for 10 o'clock this morning. The 23-year-old, seen as one of his country's brightest prospects, but his off-field behaviour saw his contract with the Australian Union cancelled last month. The Irish Rugby League team were beaten 32-14 by Fiji in their World Cup opener in Rochdale last night. Fiji ran in 6 tries to Ireland's 3. Tyrone McCarthy, Damien Blanch and James Hassan all crossed the line for the Irish. The Irish coach, very disappointed, Mark Aston.
You cough up the ball in your own end, they're going to cause you problems, these sort of teams, and they did. And you know, we made 3 mistakes on the first play and they went on to score tries on the back of that. So a little bit disappointed. You know, I'm not going to fault the boys for the effort. I thought they stuck in there. We didn't play particularly smart.
Well, the first leg of a massive game was played in Bray last night. Longford Town came from 2 goals down to draw 2-2 with Bray Wanderers in the Electricity League promotion relegation playoff. First leg, as I mentioned last night, the second leg takes place on Friday night. It's been reported that goalkeeper for Manchester City, Joe Hart, will be dropped for their League Cup clash with Newcastle tomorrow. Manuel Pellegrini has refused to back Hart publicly after his latest mistake cost City a 2-1 defeat to Chelsea at the weekend. 5 games in that League Cup tonight. Arsenal taking on Chelsea. Birmingham play Stoke. Burnley meet West Ham. Fulham travel to Leicester. And Manchester United entertain Norwich City. In hurling, Portumna claimed their 6th Galway crown yesterday thanks to a 3-12-14-point victory over Loughrea. Joe Canning, Andy Smith and Damien Hayes scored the Portumna goals. Andy Smith was man of the match.
We hadn't won a county title since 2009, and I mean, we tried so hard the last few years, but we just didn't have the hunger and intensity and which you need at this level to get the breakthrough. And I think it was just a combination of so many years on the road and so many years together that maybe things just fizzled out a wee bit over them few years. But we came back this year and we made a pact at the start of the year that we'd give it everything we have for the Portumna jersey and the crest, and thank God today it panned out like that.
An emotional day in Salt Hill yesterday. Tributes paid to the late Niall Donoghue before and after the game. And Cloyne hurler Conor Cusack has opened up on his battle against depression in an online blog. Now, he published it yesterday, a day after the funeral of Niall Donoghue. Conor is a brother of former Cork star Donal O'Cusack, and it's been doing the rounds on social media overnight. If you get a moment today, I do urge you to read it. A really inspiring story.
It's beautifully written as well. It really packs a punch.
It's one of the finest pieces of writing I've read in a long time, Rachel, I'll be honest with you. We're going to post it on the Morning Ireland Twitter account very shortly, so stay tuned there. In athletics, over 14,000 people completed the Airtricity Dublin Marathon yesterday. Sean Hare and Maria McCambridge won the men's and women's events. Paul Hannan took the honours in the wheelchair race. Don Cossack made a very impressive fencing debut at Galway yesterday for Giggenstown Stud. He won the WB Gavin & Co Beginners Chase by 20 lengths. Finally, the Boston Red Sox have taken a 3-2 lead in the World Series. They were 3-1 winners over St. Louis Cardinals last night.
Well, earlier on when we heard from from the Teachers Union of Ireland, who aren't entirely happy with some aspects of the proposed changes to the junior cert. As you may have heard by now, that exam is to be revamped, with changes scheduled to begin on a phased basis next year for the first examination in 2017. Let's get the view now of Dr. Tony Hall of the School of Education at NUI Galway. He's also editor of the Education Matters Yearbook. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
This new system will involve teachers being very much part of the assessment process. They will have to assess their own students in many cases. Is that a good idea, do you think?
It is, I think, in teachers, through their professionalism, they have significant experience of assessing their own students heretofore. And they'll also have input into the design of the curriculum in schools as well.
Right, but could there be drawbacks? I mean, we heard earlier from the TUI that, you know, it mightn't happen that much, but that there will be pressure perhaps in some schools to inflate the grades.
Yes, this is has been found in the UK context with the GCSE system, Rachel, where there are problems with the coursework in particular. And the British Educational Research Association, the BERA, found in recent research that science teachers were under pressure, particularly to inflate grades, and particularly in one of the other reforms that goes hand in hand with the junior cycle is the school self-evaluation, which is going to place also pressure on schools in relation to the introduction of kind of transparency for the school community as well.
How do you guard against a problem like that then?
Well, certainly I think the, you know, it's very well documented there was a need, the rationale, much in some ways like Donal O'Malley in 1967 with the abolition of the primary certificate. And the view would be that there isn't necessarily a need at this stage, possibly, for a terminal examination for young people at that stage in their lives, because 9 out of 10 young people now will go on to complete the leaving certificate. And I think certainly at the heart of this has to be appropriate and properly resourced continuing professional development and upskilling for teachers, and also investment in initial teacher education to ensure the teachers are best positioned to undertake this.
The TUI were saying to us earlier that they don't think that the resources currently in place are adequate, and they were pretty sceptical about whether this new system could be introduced, even though it is on a phased basis, whether it could be introduced next year. What do you think yourself?
Yes, I think Bernie Judge earlier raised very salient concerns about the proposed new junior cycle, and to safeguard its robustness and ensure that it's a reliable, equitable approach to assessment in schools, there will need to be certainly proper resourcing and funding for this and support for teachers, and perhaps more than currently and as is proposed.
Mm. I suppose the tendency of all of us at a time like this is to start talking about teachers and systems and the like. But what about the people who matter most, the pupils? Is this good news for them, do you think?
Potentially. Again, you know, the concerns that Bernie raised are very salient around the need to ensure a robust examination assessment system. Definitely the proposals bring with them the possibility for students to be better prepared for the future. That, for example, in the pilot schools in Colossia-Curon in County Limerick, for example, where they have piloted the new junior cycle, they've been able to design courses, teachers and students, where students have more of an idea at this formative key stage, these very formative first 3 years in post-primary. They have a better idea going into the senior cycle of what they might want to do in their career and where they might want to go after school and education.
The thing is, though, they are going to go into a senior cycle where all of a sudden, once again, it does become all about the big final exam.
Absolutely, Rachel. And again, I think also we have an opportunity with this reform to pilot some of the changes that we might then adapt and adopt into senior cycle. Again, it does our students no service really for them to have, you know, again, what we were trying to do is turn down, as Sean Flynn said at the time, is to turn down the heat on this mini leaving certificate, which the junior cert had become. But we do our students a disservice if we don't have that seamlessness through to senior cycle. And that's part also of the rationale for the junior cycle, is to have a better connection with early childhood, early years education, primary and the early years of post-primary. But we have to look seriously at senior cycle as well and how that can be reformed fundamentally and foundationally to make it a better education system for all children in Ireland.
Dr. Tony Hall of the School of Education at NUIG, thanks indeed for talking to us. It's for
to Syria next, where it's reported that the Assad administration has filed details of its poison gas and nerve agent program and its plan to destroy it. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has confirmed that the government has provided the information. So is this the kind of progress we expected? Alistair Hay is a professor at the University of Leeds and is on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning.
What new have we learned from what the Assad administration has made known to the organisation?
Well, we know that the composition of what he has is slightly less complex than initially feared. Most of the material seems to be in the form of precursors, that is, the chemicals which you mix together to make the finished chemical weapon. So most of it is in bulk chemicals, and they're much less toxic to deal with than the likes of sarin, which, you know, killed all those people in the town of Ghouta near Damascus back in August. And so they will be easier to deal with. I suppose that's how to phrase it.
Also, reading some coverage about it, there were reports that some of the mixing agents were found in locations which would seem to have revealed something significant about the kind of strategy the administration was using in terms of trying to use these.
Yes, it seems that the idea was that most of the chemical weapons would be made fairly shortly before they were going to be used. So there are a number of mobile mixing facilities that the regime declared. So it was a case of mix it, make it and use it pretty soon after the thing was put together.
Just in conclusion, Alistair, how soon before we see these chemicals begin to be destroyed or be removed from the country, if that can happen?
Well, I think that will happen over the next few months. And I think the OPCW feels that it will meet its target within the middle of next year, because some of the chemicals will be destroyed on site, but there are provisions for the chemicals to be taken to other countries, to other facilities as well, where they'll be destroyed.
OK, thank you for that. Alistair Hay, Professor of Environmental Toxicology at the University of Leeds.
Pre-famine traditional Irish music collected by a Church of Ireland clergyman from Ventry will be among the pieces to feature in a special concert to mark the 25th anniversary of the Irish Traditional Music Archive next month. Our reporter Justin McCarthy went along to the archive on Dublin's Merrion Square to find out more.
I think people are always interested in the story behind the tune or the song, and that's what they can find here. They can find out, I suppose, the earliest recording of a particular tune or song here. They can find the earliest printed source, and I suppose it adds to the music.
It's the biggest collection of its kind in the world, and this year the Irish Traditional Music Archive is celebrating its 25th anniversary.
This collection is freely open to the public. Anyone who walks in the door can listen to, read, view, study, if they like, anything that we have here.
Nicholas Carolyn, known widely as presenter of the TV series Come West Along the Road, is the archive's director.
They might just be interested in hearing a record that they loved 30 years ago, don't know where it is now, can't get it. So a personal interest to professional interest to academic interest, and then that's not counting the people who access our digitised website material throughout the world.
There are over 900,000 items on the archive's database. Maeve Grabours looks after printed material.
Maybe the material would have existed in different places all over the country, but the fact that it's all here and it's accessible through a database where you can actually find the information, I mean, it's no good to people if you can't actually, get at the information. And by having it all catalogued in such detail, that's how people can pull out the information out of the books and the recordings that we have here.
Well, even though our main thrust is to document all contemporary Irish traditional music, get every new recording, of course, we also have a coverage of historic material. And among the oldest recordings we have in the archive are interesting cylinder recordings made by a Galway piper in the United States, Patsy Two. He's a famous professional piper over there and set up his own record company making cylinder recordings about 1901. And remarkably, we still have them.
The Munster Gimlet by Patsy Two.
The archive on Dublin's Merrion Square is equipped with a custom-built studio where musicians have been rehearsing for a special 25th anniversary concert at the Abbey Theatre in Dublin on November 10th. Among the performers will be the fiddle player and Archive's founder, Paddy Glacken.
I don't think anybody can actually sit down and predict what will be traditional music in 50 years' time. I wouldn't have an idea. I mean, if you'd said to me even 25, 30 years ago that it would be as healthy as it is today, I wouldn't have believed you. But there it is. Like, it's in a really, really healthy state.
How's that, Brian? How are the levels?
Yeah, the levels are perfect there, Danny.
The anniversary concert will feature pre-famine music compiled by James Goodman, a Church of Ireland clergyman who, in his own way, contributed enormously to the archive's treasure trove of resources.
He was born in Ventry, and unusually, given his religious background, he was a native speaker. He sang in Irish, he danced, he played the flute, and he was an outstanding Uilleann piper. He made it as a personal collection on manuscript during his lifetime, and especially in the 1860s. I think, conscious that the famine had done untold damage to traditional music, he was trying to preserve what he himself knew and had heard.
Nicholas Carolan ending that report from Justin McCarthy, and tickets for that special anniversary concert featuring household names including Liam O'Flynn, Donal Lunny and Micheál O'Sullivan are available from the Abbey Theatre. They cost 25 to 30 euro and any profits will go back into the archive.
There's some good news this morning for North Roscommon. The old Garda barracks in Cuthall, where John McGahern lived with his father after his mother died when he was just 10 years old, is to be developed into a reading room and library. The building, which will be for familiar to readers of McGahern's The Barracks and Memoir, has been secured by the community from the Office of Public Works. It closed as a Garda station 2 years ago. Maurice Gannon of the Cuthall Community Development Group has been speaking to me about how the latest development came about.
Well, the Garda station closed down just under 2 years ago. And, what happened was our group had an interest in seeing what we could do with that. Now, just through the help of our local TD, basically connections were made with the OPW, the relevant people within the OPW, and correspondence started and has been ongoing since, culminating in this news that Brian Hayes will be coming to Cuthall on the 3rd of December.
What are you planning?
Okay, well, the building itself, the residence part of it, the former residence part of it, that will be transformed into a community space, just simply forward. It's a small rural community, a small rural village, and just meeting space for local groups. However, the old Garda station itself, which is separate from the residence, that will be transformed into a library stroke a reading room commemorating John McGahern.
For people who would know the sort of North Roscommon and the Leitrim area in which McGahern grew up, lived and worked, it's so soon since his passing, there aren't many visible signs of his presence. This will be the first significant one, will it not?
This is quite significant. Yes, there's a commemorative plaque that our own group, Cuthall Community Development Group, we put that up in, I think it was 2008, and certainly this will be the most significant commemoration for the late John McGahern.
What aspects of his life do you intend concentrating on in this centre that makes this significant?
Well, obviously, the barracks itself is a huge part. Naturally enough, that was associated with literally the barracks there. But what we intend to do is, there's quite a lot of knowledge locally of the McGahern family, of John McGahern as a young boy, and we intend to establish an oral history, so they have it available for the flocks of visiting McGahern enthusiasts. They can come along and listen to the stories of McGahern growing up in the community.
You've made the decision to go ahead with the project. You've secured the building, but the real work starts now. How are you going to fund it, and how much do you project it will cost?
The initial ballpark figures we're looking at in excess of €100,000. The building itself, the residence part of it is it's a lot in a state of disrepair. It's going to take a considerable amount of money, but we'll get there. Already, our own group, we we established what was known as the Barracks Garden, which is literally next door to the barracks. There's ongoing work there at the moment for a park. So we were able to secure funding there from through the Rural Development Programme, Roscommon Leader Partnership and Roscommon County Council, and that's there's €150,000 has already gone into that with contributions from the local community.
That's Maurice Gannon of the Coot Hall Community Development Group, and good luck to them with that project. It's almost a minute to nine.